From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Artie Motz-Cohen. On today's Fresh Air, crime and its fascination. We feature a panel that brings together writers and officials who deal with crime to discuss the fact, the fiction, and the fascination of crime in America. The event was sponsored by the writers group PEN and includes writers Walter Mosley, Joyce Carol Oates, as well as former New York City Police Commissioner Richard Condon, and Judge Edwin Torres, who wrote Carlito's Way. Also, Maureen Carrigan reviews Daisy Bates in the Desert by Julia Blackburn. It's part biography, part novel, and part fairy tale. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The chief Democratic vote counter in the House says Democrats now have the votes needed to bring the crime bill up for a vote. But the White House and some supporters of the bill say the fight may not be over yet. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
Opponents of the assault weapons ban that's contained in the crime bill have been using procedural roadblocks to prevent consideration of the bill worked out by House and Senate negotiators. New York Democrat Charles Schumer is calling on fellow members to ignore the National Rifle Association and bring the crime bill to the floor for a vote.
This crime bill has $8 billion for prisons. This crime bill has the death penalty. This crime bill has three strikes and you're out. So all the other ballyhoo that they care about fighting crime is a lot of baloney.
Schumer says the major law enforcement groups support passage of the crime bill and suggested those who don't are actually front groups for the NRA. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton is criticizing Texas Senator Phil Graham. She says the Republican has been ranting and raving about socialized medicine. The First Lady says she believes Graham is motivated by political opportunism with his attacks on the Democratic health care reform plan in the Senate. Graham has threatened to filibuster the bill. Debate on the issue is expected to open in the Senate today. Israel and Jordan began the tough task of removing obstacles to a full peace treaty today. Officials from both countries are meeting at a location along the Dead Sea to negotiate details for a common border, economic issues, and water rights. The BBC's Lise Doucette reports.
Jordan and Israel have had numerous occasions in recent weeks to discuss their outstanding problems, ranging from summit meetings to official talks. But Israel has yet to echo Jordan's repeated assertion that Israel is occupying some of its land and is taking more than its fair share of water. Jordanian sources say the two sides agreed to use more diplomatic language. In their joint statements, they've mentioned mutual recognition of water rights and common maps to demarcate their border. Jordan's information minister, Jawad Al-Anani, said the two sides will now get down to the substance of their differences in the bilateral talks which reopened today. He told the BBC he expects some problems when it comes to demarcating the border, particularly in the north.
Lise Doucette reporting. A grand jury in Pensacola, Florida, has indicted Paul Hill on two counts of first-degree murder. Hill is charged with shooting to death an abortion doctor and his escort a week and a half ago. Hill could face either the death penalty or life in prison with no chance for parole for 25 years. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 2.5 points at 3,756. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq Composite Index has risen 0.5 point. This is NPR. Fire inspectors are still investigating the mysterious blaze that burned a high school in Wadawi, Alabama. They're checking the ashes and charred debris that used to be Randolph High School. The state fire marshal says arson is one possibility, but the townspeople believe it is the cause, given the school principal's notoriety. Hewland Humphreys touched off a furor earlier this year by threatening to cancel the school prom because he didn't want interracial couples showing up. The school board backed him then, but last night it voted to move him to an administrative job. A Norwegian cruise ship ran aground in thick fog off the coast of Alaska today. Nearly 1,300 people were aboard the ship. No injuries have been reported. Paula Dobbin of member station KTOO in Juneau has the story.
The cruise ship New Amsterdam was heading north from Vancouver when it ran aground hard this morning. The grounding took place at Gravina Point, about 3 miles south of Ketchikan. The ship refloated a short time later, but the Coast Guard says hydraulic fluid is leaking from the stern. Coast Guard Lieutenant Ray Massey says authorities are assessing the damage.
We have emergency safety investigators from Ketchikan on board. We have the Coast Guard cutter Anna Cap alongside, and the vessel's being held in position by tugs while divers go below and check out the damage to the hull.
The ship deployed containment booms after the grounding occurred. Authorities say the oil spill is expected to dissipate quickly. No word on what caused the grounding. A marine investigation is underway. For National Public Radio, I'm Paula Dobbin in Juneau.
A realtors group says it's harder for Americans to buy a previously owned home. The National Association of Realtors says its housing affordability index dropped for the second straight quarter. The realtors say higher mortgage rates are to blame. They say a typical, American family could afford a $145,000 home if they earned a median income of about $39,000. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. On and off for the past 2 months, America has been glued to its TV sets watching the aftermath of a hideous crime unfold, the murder of Nicole Simpson and Ronald Goldman. It would have been hard for a novelist or a screenwriter to dream up a scenario as dramatic and riveting as the one real life has presented and the media has heightened. The intersection of crime, criminality, truth, and fiction was explored in a panel discussion called Cops and Writers, Crime and Punishment in Literature and Real Life. It was presented this spring by the Penn American Center and the New York Review of Books at New York University. Today on Fresh Air, we're bringing you highlights from that gathering. The panelists included former New York City Police Commissioner Richard J. Condon, former New York City homicide detective Michael Sheehan, who's now an investigative reporter for Fox News, and New York State Supreme Court Judge Edwin Torres, who's also the author of three books, including Carlito's Way and After Hours. Also on the panel were writers Walter Mosley, Joyce Carol Oates, Linda Wolfe, and Evan Hunter, also known as Ed McBain. The moderator for the group was newspaper columnist Murray Kempton, who asked the panelists how they got interested in crime and criminality. We start with Mike Sheehan's response.
The first things that got me interested in police work was as a young boy sitting on a stoop up in Spanish Harlem. And we'd chip in and we'd buy, I think, the Daily Mirror, not to get into the newspapers. I heed your warning. But you get the Daily Mirror, let's say. Some outrageous headline. Actually looks kind of tame in light of what we see today in our papers. But you'd have an outrageous headline about a terrible homicide somewhere in the city. And the fascination among the guys on that stoop was, how in God's name are they ever going to find this guy? This is a city of 8 million people. Naked City tells us this every night. You know, there's 8 million stories. Where are they going to get this guy? You know, where are they going to start? And I think that's what the beginning of a lot of our writers probably is the same. I mean, it's a fascination with the underbelly of the city, the fascination with the bizarre. What makes somebody do it, and then what drives a detective and the cops? How do they find this guy in a city of 8 million people? And the fascinating thing, for me at least, with 3 days after you'd see this terrible headline, there'd be another picture on all the front pages of two members of what we used to call the Beef Trust. Two big beefy detectives with cigars, and they'd be dragging a guy into the station house in cuffs. How did they get this guy? Where did they get him? And it was a fascination that lasted. I was a foot patrolman in Harlem, radio car. I worked in narcotics. I was an undercover. I was lucky enough to go into the detective bureau and eventually homicide, and I found out for myself.
Thank you very much. Linda?
Yes, I wanted to say that I write true crime, but I came to it through fiction. And I just want to say a little bit about that. In the 60s, early 60s, I was writing fiction and publishing in literary magazines. And I was very dissatisfied with my short stories because I felt that they didn't have an engine. I hadn't had enough life experience, nothing really had happened to me. I was looking inside myself, and the stories that I wrote were not real enough somehow. And so I started clipping stories out of the newspapers, and I used to save these clippings, which I still have, that are sort of moldering in this drawer of mine. Mysterious death in Topeka, Kansas. This is a very good one, by the way, if there's any writer out there. It was a 1962 killing of a woman who was a patient at the Menninger Clinic, and they never found her killer. And I have a whole bunch of these things. And finally, after a while, I thought maybe I'll switch and try and write about these real things. It took a long time, because at that point in the early 60s, Tom Wolfe, who's no relation of mine, I'm sorry to say, but has said that the fiction writers were the true creative people, and journalists were looked upon as a kind of lesser creature. They were merely, I think he calls them slag diggers. And they just went out and dug and brought back facts. But you, to be really a creative person, you had to be writing fiction. Now, as we all know, this has changed in the last 20 years. There's been a burst of wonderful journalism, I guess starting with Capote, and it's particularly in the area of crime, and particularly when the crime writer tries to use the tools of fiction and to think the way a fiction writer does, to get inside the mind of the criminal or the victim.
Mr. Hunter.
I'm not even sure I'm that fascinated with crime. When I first began writing, the markets opened to me as a young writer were the pulp magazines. I don't know if you're all familiar with those. They were about the size of this pad, and the covers, they were printed on this very grainy, yellowish paper that had leaves and twigs floating in it, so which is why they were called pulp, because it was pulp wood that they made it from. And the covers were usually printed in the primary colors, which are red, yellow, and blue, and usually showed a woman in jeopardy of, if it were a science fiction or pulp, she was usually being threatened by a bug-eyed monster of some sort. And, detective pulp is usually an Oriental for some reason threatening her. And they were all very scantily clad, except in the romance pulps, where there was just usually a woman with a horse on the cover. But the four major categories were detective, science fiction, Western, and romance. And I was born and raised in New York. I'd never been on a horse in my life. The romance market was mostly written by women writers. In college, the science I took was geology. And it seemed easy to write about crime. It just seemed easier. And they paid a quarter of a cent a word for these stories. And if you used a lot of ands and thes, you could make a fortune. I think what interests me more than crime, and I'll explain this in a moment where I'm going, is change. And I think that since I've written both straight novels and crime novels, I tried to figure out what is the difference between the two. Because I feel that any good novel should be about change, something that happens to a character that causes some sort of epiphany, whether the change is insight or recognition or even the realization that the character will never change. That in itself is change of a sort. But we read the straight novel and get involved in these events, and we wait for the change that will come in the character. In the crime novel, on the other hand, the change comes at the very beginning of the novel. There is a murder. There is an aberration in the orderly flow of events, a change. And the hero or heroine comes in and tries to set that change, tries to reverse that change, tries to create order where the change has made chaos. So we stay with the crime novel where the change has already occurred, only to make certain that it will be righted again. Things will be okay at the end. We will be able to pull the covers under our noses and sleep the sleep of babes. I think that people are fascinated with crime novels because they're so terrified themselves of becoming victims. The crime novel assures them that the people who are out there committing the crimes will be brought to justice, will be apprehended, will be brought before a court, will be found guilty, and will be sent to prison. And it gives us a sense of security. It takes us away from the real crime that's in the street everywhere around us, and makes us feel safe, makes us feel that this body of laws we have created over centuries and centuries and centuries to protect ourselves from each other and also from ourselves, this body of law works. That's why we read the crime novel, I think.
That was writer Evan Hunter, a.k.a. Ed McBain, speaking at a panel discussion on crime and punishment in literature and real life. It was presented by the International Writers Organization, PEN, and the New York Review of Books on April 18th at New York University. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're back listening to a panel discussion recorded this spring about crime, police work, and writing about crime. We'll hear from Linda Wolf, Evan Hunter, and Joyce Carol Oates, who tells us how crime affected her family and her work. First, a discussion about whether or not cops become callous to criminals and how that might affect the quality of their work. Mike Sheehan, a TV reporter and former homicide detective, offers these thoughts.
Any detective worth his salt in this country, who has a theory and locks himself into the theory. Mm-hmm. And then let's say the guy gets transferred or he retires, whatever. The next detective who comes in now, let's say the case is still open, he picks up that case, which should read, by the way, like a novel. It should read that way. The worst thing that I've ever seen among the police is like the above exited, the perpetrator. Look. You try to read that, especially on a stand, read somebody else's work to a jury who wants, they're there to be entertained. They want to know. That's true. They want to know exactly what happened. And you're giving them all of this, and therefore, and the undersigned. I always wrote in the first person. I had some bosses that didn't care for that, but, today, myself and Ed Torres went into 117 East 119th Street. And we spoke to Maggie Gonzalez on the first floor. She told us her son wasn't home, but that he left his gun in the top drawer. And Papo borrowed it last night. And if you read like that, I think you come across better. It's more credible. But now, getting back to locking himself in, when you pick up that case folder, if everything you read was created, every piece of paper was created by that detective who says that this guy, I'm positive this guy did it, and this is why he did it, et cetera, et cetera. The crust, as we spoke about before, becomes really apparent. He gets sucked into this, and you're going off on a totally wrong tangent. You might have a total, a guy that no one ever even looked at is the suspect.
So the initial cop's view of it will carry down to the subsequent cops investigating?
Well, I'm talking about the initial investigator. Let's say if you have one investigator who puts a lot of his time into a case, the worst thing that you can do as an investigator is to get locked in. You must keep an open mind, as the judge
says. But will his view prevail down the line?
Hopefully not, if he's going to be one of those guys who locks himself in.
Unless he's right.
That's true, Chris.
Does anyway, you are doing so much better than I am. Do you have anything to say? I would like to find out about law officers getting callous, not because it means they make mistakes, because it means they they've lost their humanity, which seems to me terribly important to a law officer. Not that you ever lost yours, Judge. But,
God forbid.
How about yours?
Mine?
And yours is fine. I was asking Mike about his, because he's now in television. And
oh, okay.
It really breeds it.
Now I've turned callous. Right. Now I'll learn how to tell a story in 2 minutes. That's callous. especially for an Irishman.
Right.
No, but it is impossible. I've taken over 1,000 homicide confessions, and the callous guy is not going to get that confession. You know, contrary to all this popular belief, the rubber hose and all that stuff, and you better tell us, or that doesn't work. You know, maybe the criminal today is too well educated. I don't know. They certainly know their rights. And although many of them waive their right to an attorney, they have this impulse to speak, to tell their story, which leads them down the path to the confession. And in many cases, thank God, from a police point of view, because there was no physical evidence, et cetera, at the case. And the Chambers case is a prime example. Without that confession, I doubt whether he'd be upstate today, you know?
Someone told me that there are more confessions now than there were before Miranda.
That's amazing.
Well, I wouldn't doubt it. And one of the greatest tools, the videotape today, is probably the greatest tool for law enforcement. Mm. But it's an amazing thing. Even you'd think that they would have these discussion groups in prison. So like, hey, did you talk to the cops? Yeah. Stupid move, huh?
Dumb.
You know. But they don't do that. They don't do that. And it's an amazing phenomenon.
Mike, I've been wondering about that. I've never understood how, when you tell the guard, you know, when you start reading his rights, that he then doesn't clam up. What is the thing that...
A lot of them think that they can rationalize. In Robert Chambers' case, he thought he was smarter than every detective there. You know,
if I may interject. Sure. There's also, from my experience in Homicide Bureau, there's also the purging catharsis factor. When you apprehend an individual fresh on the heels of this, like, you know, he stabbed, like I've had, you know, 70 stab wounds, there's a period there, I think Michael will corroborate this, maybe 24 hours when they want to talk about it. They want to get it off their chest,
yeah,
literally.
It's the Raskolnikov.
Exactly.
Well, now, we have here four writers who have examined the criminal line and known criminal types over a long period of interest. Does each of you have something, some discovery about what makes criminals that has struck you as particularly useful?
Well, while my fellow panelists were speaking, I was thinking how in my own lifetime, I haven't really known any criminals, but I've known so many victims. And I guess it's sort of a macho thing to identify with the perpetrator, who tends to often be male. And I was surprised at what Walter said, though I'm sure he's correct, that most victims of violence are actually men. We think of women and children being abused and battered, raped, and murdered in this country in alarming degrees. And I don't have the statistics at my fingertips, you know, to quote them, but they really are astounding. The degree of violence perpetrated against women and against children. Anyway, my background is sort of working class or maybe below working class. I come from upstate New York in a very rural community. And this is some time ago. And I won't embarrass myself by saying how many decades ago. But there was a good deal of crime going on of a domestic violence type. And it's possible, or even quite probable, that these crimes were not so defined then, and they were not reported to any police. But I lived in a world where men worked in factories, and or they were unemployed or on strike, but never in control of their lives as earners or breadwinners of a family. I mean, they might have to go out on strike or they might just be laid off. And so it was a world in which the economy was very precarious and the men did a lot of drinking both in my own family and our neighbors and so forth. And a man would get drunk, and he would go after his family. We would hear screams from next door. My father would go next door and try to help the children or the wife who was being threatened with a butcher knife. He would himself being threatened by being punched, you know. And none of this, I think, was ever reported to the police. And at the time, nobody would have said the man who got drunk and beat up his children and wife was a criminal. But yet today, we would say that this is a crime, and he would be, I hope, he would be reported. So the statistics today are in, you know, they're different from what they used to be. And at the very beginning of my own life, even before I was born, my life was determined by an act of murder. My grandfather was murdered, and because of that, my mother, who was the youngest of about 9 children in a very poor farm family, had to be given away. I'm not telling any secrets. I've actually written about this. But I've written about it in much in a context of language. I feel I'm blushing because I'm speaking kind of awkwardly and falteringly now. And it's not a family secret, but my whole life and my mother's life and everything subsequent to that was really deflected by an act of murder. But nobody would ever talk about it in my family. I learned about it when I was an adult. It's just that we always had the consequences of it. And we lived in a world in which I went to one-room schoolhouse, and as I say, it was a very impoverished part of the world. And there were definitely acts of what we call sexual harassment would have been a luxury in that world. The things that went on, and we would hear about acts of incest that these boys would be boasting that they had forced their younger sisters into doing. So as I said earlier, my identification, it's a very involuntary sympathy, is with the victims. But I would like to make the victims individuals and show that they have their own personalities and their anger and integrity. They're not flat, two-dimensional cartoon figures who are just sort of on the floor, you know, and of no interest, while the perpetrators are these macho characters that Norman Mailer would be infatuated with. I don't find these, the Jack Abbotts of the world, so mesmerizing, and I read a lot about serial killers, a lot more than I needed to read, I think. I mean, I don't find them fascinating. I think many of their victims who've survived have been extraordinarily courageous. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one thing that possibly women writers and maybe other men as well, but it's a focus less on crime and the criminal as a man of action, less on that than on the victims who are human too.
In a good mystery novel, really finding out what the victim was all about is what leads to uncovering mm-hmm. the murderer. Absolutely. So that the very process, the unfolding of a mystery novel, is learning all about the victim. Mm.
That was Joyce Carol Oates and Evan Hunter, a.k.a. Ed McBain, two of the panelists in a discussion hosted by the international writers organization PEN and the New York Review of Books recorded this spring. We'll be presenting more highlights in the second half of our show. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Coming up, some true-life crime stories that are stranger than any novel. We continue our discussion about the fact and the fiction of crime with a panel of writers and officials who deal with crime. And Maureen Carrigan reviews Daisy Bates in the Desert, about an eccentric woman who went alone into the Australian outback and stayed for nearly 50 years. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Rebel Bosnian Muslims from Bihać are fleeing into Serbian-held areas of Croatia. The soldiers are being chased by fighters from the Bosnian government. A United Nations spokesman says the rebel Bihać soldiers have been crushed. Richard Carruthers filed this report for the BBC from Zagreb.
A United Nations spokesman said that several hundred soldiers and thousands of civilians had crossed from the Bosnian Muslim enclave into Serb-held Croatia. The movement happened overnight and on Tuesday morning. Those fleeing Bihać are people loyal to the local Muslim businessman Fikret Abdic. He broke away from the Sarajevo government last September and declared Bihać to be an autonomous province with himself as president. Mr. Abdic argued that Bihać, which is surrounded by Bosnian and Croatian Serbs, needed to make its own peace with them. On occasions, he's even received military help from Serb forces. However, in recent months, soldiers from the south of the enclave, who remained loyal to Bosnian President Alija Izetbegović, have been advancing against Mr. Abdic's forces.
Richard Carruthers reporting. The Justice Department says Attorney General Janet Reno has asked a federal judges panel to appoint an independent counsel to investigate charges against Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy. The FBI has been investigating charges that Espy accepted gifts from the poultry industry in violation of federal law. Idaho authorities report their wildfire situation has grown much worse in the central part of the state. One fire tripled in size overnight. Lee Garnett of Northwest Public Radio reports.
Firefighters in the Payette National Forest have ordered a military battalion to help them control two large blazes a few miles from the resort town of McCall. The largest is the Corral Fire, which merged with a smaller fire overnight and now consumes 32,000 acres. Linda Wagoner is an information officer with the Payette National Forest.
Occasionally it was moving as fast as a mile an hour. So it's cause of concern just because it grew so big so fast.
The other fire, called the Blackwell Complex, has grown to over 10,000 acres. It is about 8 miles from the Corral Fire. Both fires are in steep terrain and are not yet posing a threat to populated areas. For National Public Radio, I'm Lee Garnett reporting.
California officials say the worst seems to be over in the Northern California wildfires. Officials say they've contained one fire in the Sierra Nevada foothills, and they expect to surround another this evening. Exxon says all seven workers hurt in explosions and a fire at a Louisiana chemical plant have been treated and released from hospitals. The workers suffered minor injuries yesterday while climbing a chain-link fence as they tried to run away from the blast. The cause of the explosions at the chemical plant aren't yet known. They triggered a large fire, which is still burning. Stock prices closed mixed today on Wall Street. The Dow was up 2 points to end the day at 3,755. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. A political deadlock has been broken in the Senate Commerce Committee on a bill that would allow telecommunications companies to offer a variety of new services. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The logjam was broken when members of the Senate panel reached a compromise on a set of key ground rules. The provisions outline what rules regional telephone companies must follow in order to compete with long-distance carriers. The tentative compromise frees up telecommunications companies to offer a variety of futuristic services and devices. Sources say the new measure removes some of the strict legal tests required under the original legislation offered by Commerce Committee Chairman Ernest Hollings, a South Carolina Democrat. The new Senate compromise would expand the list of incidental services local telephone companies may provide without having to receive special regulatory approval. In addition to opening up the long-distance business, Hollings' bill would let cable and local telephone companies enter each other's lines of business and would let regional phone companies manufacture telecommunications equipment. Both the Federal Communications Commission and the Justice Department would have to approve local phone company entry into the long-distance industry. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
President Clinton has ordered an immediate inquiry in how the U.S. government started building a $310 million spy satellite headquarters. Congress was not told how big it would be or how much it would cost. A White House spokeswoman says Mr. Clinton wants a full accounting to the American people on how the tax dollars are being spent. Relief workers in Rwandan refugee camps say typhoid is the new disease they're worried about. A deadly fever thought to be typhus has killed 19 people in one camp near Goma, Zaire. Relief workers fear the disease will spread. The spokesman for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees says 30 cases have been reported in the past few days. He says blood samples have had to be flown to France for testing. Typhus is a generic name for infectious diseases characterized by high fever. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. We're back with taped highlights from a panel discussion, Cops and Writers, Crime and Punishment in Literature and Real Life. The event was presented by the Pan American Center and the New York Review of Books on April 18th at New York University. This segment leads off with mystery writer Walter Mosley talking about what might lead someone to commit a crime and the nature of crime itself.
Maybe I'll be kind of crusty on this. I have two answers to what creates a criminal. I don't really answer it, and they're not quite together. But the first one is, as a writer, I just approach the question formally. A crime occurs when my actions, according to my sense of right and wrong, disagrees with yours. That's my child, that's my money, because I earned it, because I can take it, because I need it more than you do, because I can't help myself, because it pleases me to see my power over you. It is, and it's very simple, it's very formal. You know, the idea of trying to come into a moral or ethical understanding as a writer seems useless to me because it disintegrates writing. The second, I think of Bill Sykes, you know, and Charles Dickens, Bill Sykes, because I remember it was one of the best things. I love Dickens. And one of the best, when he describes, you know, rather than going through this long social thing about Sykes, he says, Sykes' first memory was wandering down a road and he was hungry and looking for something to steal. He didn't remember his parents. He didn't remember his fluffy rabbit doll. He remembered desperation and the conviction to survive, period. He was not a nice man. Crime is relative to the society in which you find yourself. If you and your best friend are living in a cold water flat and you're hungry, the miraculous appearance of a 5-pound ham won't be questioned, at least not morally or ethically. Maybe you ask about it to see where you can get another 5-pound ham. Crime, I think, is always a betrayal. And it's a betrayal in this sense, it bites the hand that feeds you. You know, if it's not doing that, it's not wrong, at least by the people who you're surrounded by. Somebody else might think it's wrong, but that's them. I, on the other hand, don't think it's wrong. Well, yeah, he killed him, right? Well, he should have killed him. Yeah, he messed around with his wife, he should have killed him, right? You know, and you have this thing, and you understand it when people can accept people who they know who are doing things that other people define as crimes. I don't define it as a crime. So why? Listen, that's what I would do. And this is just the way that I understand the making of a criminal. It's kind of like when all of a sudden you're displaced in another world. You find yourself in Indiana, for instance. And, you know, so anyway.
I think we really get to the heart of the matter here when we're talking about the nature of crime and the so-called criminal mind. And I think that this is part of the reason I choose in half of my creative life to write about crime and criminals. But part of trying to understand why people do these strange things, why someone will go into a mom and pop grocery store with a gun in his fist, knowing there's $50 in the cash register that he may get, and knowing equally well that he's looking at 20 years in prison. That's what he's looking at down the line if he gets caught. I don't know why he would do that. I don't know why, if someone is having trouble with his wife and feels the marriage isn't working, why he wouldn't consider separation or divorce. Why he would think, I think I'll kill her.
He's still emotionally involved.
Well, the answer is that there's no sense of tomorrow, I think, in people who commit crimes like that. They're acting impulsively, and they're not organized in the same way that you and I are. They're not thinking about what is the next step. They're reacting to the situation.
I remember years and years ago, they used to have lineups in New York City, not for purposes of identification the way we have them now, but to acquaint the working detectives in each precinct with the people who were committing felonies in this city. And I remember there was, this was so shocking to me. They brought out this one woman, and the chief of detectives was talking to her, and he said, well, what happened there? What happened with, do you know that your husband is very seriously injured? And she said, yes. And he said, well, can you tell us what happened? And she was a very thin, frail-looking woman, and she said, I was watching television, and he came in and turned the channel. She said, and I went into the bathroom, and I spied a hatchet, and I brought it back in and hit him with it. And he said, do you know how many times you hit him? He said, yes, I hit him, I don't know, a lot of times. He said, you hit him 37 times, Virginia. Her name was Virginia. I'll never, you hit him 37 times. He said, do you know her condition? She said, no, I don't. He said, he's dead. So this to her was a perfectly reasonable solution for this man.
Yes.
Having turned the channel, in that case, here's a hatchet, I might as well kill him.
Evan, Evan, I had occasion to meet a murderer who had murdered his wife, and so just let's not leave this with the woman taking the axe. This fellow had murdered his wife, and his reason, as he explained it, was that she'd asked him to go out and buy a bottle of milk when he'd come home from looking for work. He was unemployed. He'd been out looking for work all day. The baby was screaming. He came home, and it was just too, you know, that asking him to go for the bottle of milk was just too much, and he got the kitchen knife and stabbed her. So this is what I mean about the suddenness. They're not considering the connection between...
But why is it a viable solution? Is it in the nature of the beast?
Getting rid of the irritation.
Oh, Evan, excuse me. These are mentally unbalanced people. I mean, these are not college professors. I'm very good friends with a public defender, and she had worked in Trenton for many years. And my friend, this public defender, she said that virtually all her clients are mentally disturbed people. And you're projecting yourself in it. You're saying, why doesn't this man go and get Rael Felder's, a divorce attorney, or someone, you know, to help him with his divorce? No, they don't. Well, Linda said they don't think. There's no concept of the future, and they are just governed by
but
their
emotions. But then insanity
emotion
would be a reasonable defense in any murder, no?
They're disturbed, but they're not schizophrenic.
Well, insane and disturbed are different.
Well, they're not legally insane.
There's got to be a history. Jeffrey Dahmer. I mean, he must have crossed her once before.
Many times.
Right, yeah.
I mean, her will could not have commanded that household. I mean, that's why you have novels.
We're listening to a discussion recorded this spring at New York University about crime, criminality, and writing. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with highlights from Cops and Writers, Crime and Punishment in Literature and Real Life. Here's New York State Supreme Court Judge Edwin Torres, who's also a novelist.
There is no field of human endeavor that provides as much grist for the literary mill as crime. I mean, I've written three novels, and I don't think I've ever coined out of whole cloth a line of dialogue. Somebody has said something that I've written somewhere. And you could not duplicate. Just in an everyday course of events in a courtroom, you hear exchanges and colloquies which are beyond. I remember when I sentenced a Nookie Sweeper in a murder case. He said, well, you know, everything to say in mitigation. said, well, I had to do what I had to do. And I said to him, okay, Nookie, now I got to do what I got to do, 20 to 5 to life. You know, I mean, you have these exchanges. We went through this thing. I mean, you couldn't invent these things. I mean, but apropos, I'll give you an example, the Cliff Fishman that she alluded to. Here's a guy, this is the complexity, inexplicability, if there's such a word, of the criminal mind. Here's a guy who was a real estate developer, a very polished gentleman with a fine apartment in Jersey and in the Palisades and whatnot, and he goes to the South Bronx. He has to extinguish his beautiful, charming wife, who is a school teacher. She teaches at Trinity, and she's a very close friend of the renowned district attorney, Linda Fasting, because they went to school together. And he's got to rub her out, he's got to whack her out, because she wants to divorce him, and he doesn't want to pay for this. So he goes to the South Bronx, and he retains the most bedraggled crew of Puerto Rican hitmen you've ever seen. And they come down to whack Mrs. Fishman out, and they bring three, as they call them, three chicks with them as sightseers, as tourists. And they converge, because he's given them explicit instructions how to follow the car from Jersey across to GW, to get off over here at 72nd, where she gets off. She puts it in the garage, and then she walks to Trinity in the West 90s. So then, of course, he jumps on a plane, he flies to Florida, being Florida by the time they take the old lady out. Meanwhile, first day they lose her on the GW bridge the first day. Second day they lose her in the garage, and the third day they lose her en route to the school. So by this time, Fishman's back in town, and they still haven't rubbed the wife out. So then they decide to shoot her in front of the school. They're waiting for her. She's got a styrofoam cup of coffee in her hand, and she's getting into the school. She's got her earrings on her watch. So the first guy, this first shooter, if you want to call it, jumps out of the car with the automatic. He starts blasting away. It knocks the watch off her wrist, deflects off her scalp, and all the rest of the bullets miss her. Okay, she has the presence of mind, which even Mike wouldn't have under the circumstances. She, as she related, she bent down after they fled in the car and picked up all of the cartridges from the automatic. She said there might be evidence later on in the case. Remember that? And I'm listening to this, and I say, this, you couldn't make this up in a month of... Okay, am I right, or am I exaggerating?
Right, and then the story of their relationship, you couldn't possibly make...
I have it, but I work.
You couldn't make this up. Do you remember that he had picked her up in Zabar's? They were standing on the line, and he noticed this charming young woman. She was considerably younger than he was, and he started talking to her and telling her that he was buying lox and bagels to have a brunch with his children, and would she care to come? And she said, well, I don't normally have anything to do with strangers, but and he said, but I'm having my three children, which is how this woman came to become involved with this crazed murderer. And
Attempted murderer,
excuse me.
But he was scouring the streets of the South Bronx.
Then he wrote poetry, and she was an English teacher.
Attempted
And he began
poetry.
Writing poetry.
We've been listening to a discussion recorded this spring at New York University. Cops and Writers, Crime and Punishment in Literature and Real Life was presented by the Pan American Center and the New York Review of Books. The panelists were Richard J. Condon, Evan Hunter, a.k.a. Ed McBain, Walter Mosley, Joyce Carol Oates, Michael Sheehan, Edwin Torres, and Linda Wolf. Murray Kempton was the moderator. Many thanks to Pamela Pierce from Penn. Fresh Air's presentation was produced by Naomi Person with Danny Miller, Nancy Greenlees, Kathy Wolf, and Fred Landrell. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about all things considered today. Linda, I understand the health care debate is scheduled to start today.
In the Senate, and Elizabeth Arnold is standing by so that if it does begin, she'll tell us what happened. Patricia Nayment is also going to have a report on the cost of various health care schemes the Congress is about to consider. We will have a story on that secret office building being built in Washington, so secret that even the members of Congress didn't know it was there. HIV in Japan, we'll have a report on that, and about long-time survivors, people who are carrying the virus but don't seem to get sick. And we'll talk to two kids from Wadawi, Alabama.
Linda, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There once was a woman who lived in the desert, and her name was Daisy Bates. That's how writer Julia Blackburn begins Daisy Bates in the Desert, her new book, which is part biography, part novel, and part fairy tale. There really was a Daisy Bates, and she really did go to live alone in the deserts of South Australia in 1905 when she was 42 years old. Bates stayed there, studying the Aborigines for most of the rest of her life. She died when she was 91. If you're wondering why you've never heard of this extraordinary woman before, there's a simple reason. Bates presents a challenge to most biographers because most of what she told people about herself was a lie. Maureen Corrigan reviews this latest attempt to locate the real Daisy Bates.
August is the cruelest month for serious literature. Anything heavier than a John Grisham or Danielle Steele novel threatens to overheat the brain. So how can I persuade you that an experimental biography about an eccentric woman, set no less in the scorching deserts of Australia, might really be something you'd enjoy right now? Well, I can tell you honestly, I probably wouldn't have turned off Baywatch and picked up Daisy Bates in the Desert if I didn't have to. But once I did start reading it, I didn't move for 3 hours. Daisy Bates' story, as largely imagined by Julia Blackburn, is one of the eeriest, most compelling tales of female adventure I've ever read. Bates is like a composite of Diane Fossey, Amelia Earhart, and Katharine Hepburn in The African Queen. The fact that Bates was also something of a con woman and a crackpot makes her completely irresistible. In part one of her book, Julia Blackburn dutifully tries to chart the history of Bates's life. But as Blackburn says, the extent and the exact details of her lies remain a difficult territory for which no good maps have survived. Blackburn is pretty sure Bates was born Daisy May O'Dwyer in Ireland around 1863. When she was about 20, Daisy emigrated to Australia and married the man who would become known as Breaker Morant. The next year, without ever divorcing him, Daisy married Jack Bates, with whom she had a son. Then Daisy returned alone to England for 5 years, where, contrary to the official story, she dabbled in spiritualism and possibly prostitution. Daisy returned to Australia with another lie on her lips. She claimed she'd been commissioned by the London Times to write about the Aborigines. She left her family for good and traveled into the desert, where she pitched a tent and nailed up a stalk of cabbage to help herself remember the color green. Bates spent her days recording the vanishing language and customs of the Aborigines. She eventually published one book. Bates sometimes called the Aborigines she befriended her cannibals. They, in turn, named her Kabarli, or white-skinned grandmother. These available facts carry Blackburn only so far, so in the next part of her biography, she fantasizes herself into Bates's silent desert world. Relying on 52 surviving boxes filled with photos and notebooks in which Bates scribbled down her thoughts, Blackburn constructs Bates's first-person voice. Here, for instance, Bates, via Blackburn, discusses the weather. I rather enjoy whirlwinds, although I know they can be dangerous. The women say that whirlwinds thrust babies into their wombs, and it is true that you feel you are held in a sort of embrace. After a storm, particles of dust can remain suspended in the air for hours or even days. The air becomes like muddy water. Judging from this description, the experience of reading Daisy Bates in the desert has a lot in common with being trapped in a whirlwind. Biography and autobiography swirl together, so do truth and lies. You struggle, at first, to see the outlines of something real through the haze. But after a while, you stop, because the story Blackburn has created is so forceful, so magical, it just sweeps you along. Blackburn gives us a Daisy Bates that even the real Daisy Bates, that restless self-fictionalizer, might have been satisfied with.
Maureen Cargan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Sue Spolin with Kathy Wolf. Our intern is Abby Beshkin. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscowane.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, women in Washington's power circles. We talk with journalist Patricia O'Brien. She was press secretary for Michael Dukakis' 1988 presidential campaign and is the author of the new novel, The Ladies' Lunch. I'm Marty Moscowane, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.